from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. We have a good show lined up for you on this Monday morning, June the 15th, 2020. And my first guest is going to be Washington County State's Attorney Rory Thibeault. I've gotten a couple of emails and messages and so on over the last few days about a very strong community concern about the release of one of Vermont's most notorious offenders, and that is a man named Harley Breer, who has lived most of his time when he's not in prison out in Marshfield. And we're going to be talking about that case there. And then in the second half hour of the program, Curtis Reed Jr. will be my guest. He is Executive Director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity. Curtis is an African-American man. Well, I'm sure he'll have some interesting things to say about recent developments, including the decision by President Trump to push his appearance in Tulsa, the rally scheduled for Tulsa, Oklahoma, back by a day because it was going to be on on June 19th, which is known as Juneteenth, a very important holiday for a lot of African Americans, and that was not seen as a good thing for the president to do in a city which happened to be about a century ago the scene of one of the United States' worst attacks by white people on people of color. In the latter part of the program, we're going to have a lot of fun. I think even though the subject is pretty serious, and that is we're going to have a little music, but we're also going to be talking about the special challenges faced by music educators and their students in the face of this coronavirus. You know, how do you have a choir or a band and maintain social distancing? How do you play a wind instrument and not expel respiratory droplets and all that? It's a pretty tough time for our young musicians and our teachers around Vermont, and we're going to be talking to some of those folks in the second hour of the program, so I'm sure that'll be an interesting conversation as well. Anyway, wanted to bring in, first off, Rory Thibeault. He is the state's attorney for Washington County, the chief prosecutor for our region here, where WDEV is located, and I really appreciate the state's attorney's willingness to come on and talk about a case which is, I think, pretty controversial in the area, actually. Good morning, Mr. Thibeault.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it. Talk to me a little bit about, first off, this man, Harley Breer, has quite a record and has crimes going back fairly. He was, I believe he was convicted of kidnapping and earlier 20 years ago or so, and he also had a rape charge. I guess that didn't end up producing a conviction. But and he has had some criminal events since then. Now what is his status? Is he actually sort of under some form of house arrest at home right now, or do you know where he is?
Yeah. So obviously there's a long history, and I'll start with that by saying that you're correct, and his notoriety within Washington County is unrivaled probably by any criminal defendant. His first run-ins with the law are over 30 years ago now in the late 1980s, spanning up to about 2 years ago when the most recent case came out. So I will say this. So in September of 2018, the state filed charges premised on a domestic assault and an unlawful restraint of a then intimate partner of Mr. Breer's. That case did resolve earlier this month after 19 months of litigation, during which time he was held without bail in jail. His current status today is on a home confinement status, which lasts until November 1st. And from there, the plea agreement contemplates two potential outcomes, which we can discuss a little bit further. But at this moment, he is subject to what would be colloquially house arrest or home confinement supervised by the Department of Corrections.
Okay. And in terms of the home confinement, is he required to wear an electronic device of any, a tracking device of any kind, or how's that work?
That's correct. So he's subject to what we call electronic monitoring, or wearing a GPS or ankle bracelet. It also requires that he provide a daily schedule defining where he's going to be at each and every point in the day, and that schedule is approved by the Department of Corrections, and they can also send field screening units to do checkups on him at any point in time, wherever he is.
And is he staying at home mostly? I mean, a lot of people are with the coronavirus, or is he going back and forth to work, or what are his regular movements like?
So I don't know the details of his day-to-day schedule, but he is allowed to progress to work during those hours. There's some restrictions on his home confinement order about driving and contact. He's not allowed to have, if he does drive to work or some other place like that, he's not allowed to, at any point in time, to have a female passenger, for example, in the vehicle. There's a number of other things. I won't go into all the details, but the Department of Corrections does have a pretty tight hold on what his schedule is and where he's allowed to be.
I wanted to mention my guest is Rory Tebow, the Washington County State's Attorney. We're talking about the Harley Breer case, Harley Breer from Marshfield. How old is he now? He's about 50 or so?
51 or so, I think.
Okay. Yeah, he is, as you put it, Mr. Tebow, probably Washington County's most notorious criminal at this point. And a lot of people are very, very worried about the fact that he is not incarcerated right now. He is under this form of home confinement or house arrest. But he is allowed to come and go to some extent under some, you know, I read through the plea agreement and it sounds like he is, he does have a number of restrictions and a number of points at which the probation and parole folks can, you know, get into his what he's doing and keep track of him. But I think it's still quite a, I mean, just what I've been, based on emails I've been getting and phone calls and so on, the source of no small consternation in the community. Now, do I understand correctly that there is some expectation that Mr. Breer will be trying to move out of state? Is that right?
That's correct. You know, maybe it's important to outline a little bit for listeners at home how we got here. And, you know, for my office, this perspective, I've been here for, you know, only a small portion of that 30 years I mentioned of his criminal history. I was here the last time a case resolved in 2017, and now as state's attorney handled this most recent case. You know, every prosecution from driving with a license suspended to retail theft to a homicide is driven by the facts and evidence available. And, you know, while oftentimes we're at a high water mark when the newspaper first reports on something or when there's an affidavit of probable cause spelling out what's alleged and what happens. The resolution in this case was reached based upon a consideration of all the evidence. There were over 60 motions litigated during the course of this case, and there's been no lack of effort by the state to hold Mr. Breer accountable for his actions. Now, that said, the COVID-19 crisis has led to a lot of litigation. Many individuals who were either held without bail or serving sentence have petitioned courts to be released based upon health concerns. Mr. Breer, through his counsel, did that as well. That prompted us to go before a judge who had not been previously hearing the case, and you know, he asked up front, is there any chance of resolution on this matter? There had not been much in the way of resolution discussions, but that was the opportunity where Mr. Breer's attorney revealed some of the defense evidence in this case, and they've had the assistance of a private investigator, and one of the very substantial things that impacted our ability to get a better outcome from a public perspective, perhaps, is some inconsistencies on some very important facts in the case by the complaining witness or victim, as she is in this matter. And to get into the specifics of that, there was a completely different account offered for how a shirt was ripped, and newly claiming that that was not actually part of the incident in the case, which you know, is pretty, not necessarily fatal to the case, but that really changed our calculus about whether we could or what our probability of succeeding in a contested trial was. So,
yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say those fact patterns end up being almost, they take on a life bigger than you might expect, don't they, sometimes?
Well, they do. And, you know, I know a lot of your listeners and as am I. I'm a Yankees fan, not a Red Sox fan. So when I listen to WDV, I might not always be rooting for whoever else. But, you know, I look at trial work as a baseball game. You know, not every game where we don't have to go out there in a trial setting and pitch. It's not like pitching a perfect game. But you need to come home with no runs on the board. You know, not quite. Maybe not always a no-hitter, but, you know, the state has a really heavy burden, and reasonable doubt can be generated by any number of things. And in a case like this, like many domestic violence cases, unfortunately, when there's no other third-party witnesses, the case really rises or falls on the word and credibility of a complaining witness. And that's, some people may view that as not fair. It may not be ideal, but the reality is our constitutional rights are designed to ensure that when people are faced with deprivation of life or liberty for a very, very long time, that comes by the state being forced to meet that high standard. And that often is what
they drive
agreements.
Yeah. I want to bring in a listener. Rama, I believe, is on the line from Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, Arlie Breer, that whole thing is a scary case. But I got to ask, if I, as a non-police officer, choking somebody to death, am I allowed to intervene? And that's a serious question.
Yeah, Rama's been asking me this lately, Rory Tebow. Basically, I think the question is, you know, and it stems from all the concern about police brutality, I think, around the country. If you come upon a scene
directly from what happened in Minneapolis, where we have
and if you come upon a scene where an officer, a police officer, appears to be, you describe it. I mean, what kind of a scene are you coming upon here, Rama? Police officer strangling somebody or chokehold? Somebody's in danger of death, and do you as a citizen bystander have the right to intervene? I think is that the question? It's way off topic here, but go ahead if you have an answer to that, Rory Tebow.
Well, you know, the world of what ifs is one of the things that keeps lawyers afraid, if not honest. And you know, it depends on the circumstances. Look, if someone is being, you know, brutalized or harmed, it's an individual decision in that moment of whether you defend somebody. That doesn't matter whether it's a law enforcement officer or someone else. You know, when engaging in a hostile or a fight situation like that, when intervening, you may be putting yourself at risk. You may be putting others at risk, depending on what happens. You know, I can't give a precise answer there. What I can say is Vermont law recognizes self-defense and to some extent the defense of others when there is a risk of serious bodily injury or death. And, you know, it would be largely dependent on the circumstances. What I will say is this, that I think, you know, many times we can look around the country and see horrible things happening among law enforcement or other groups. And, you know, we are fortunate in Vermont to have, I think, generally a more responsive and better trained law enforcement group overall than maybe in some other states. And, you know, I think that many, if not most or all of our officers exercise restraint and are oriented towards policing communities in a way that's consistent with Vermont values and their own values. You know, I know that there's been a lot said and a lot referenced about the increase in officer-involved shootings in the past decade. I think there were 17 from 2010 up until the end of 2019, which was almost double the decade before. You know, the real question I have is this. Is that a function of a lack of training? Is it officers being put in more dangerous situations? Is it a collision of mental health and increased access to firearms? I don't know offhand what those answers are. What I do know is that there are people throughout state government working very hard to address this in the future and make sure that we avoid this. It goes without saying that if the public doesn't have confidence in what law enforcement is doing, then how can we have confidence in any part of the justice system? How can we feel safe? How can we feel secure? And moreover, how can people on the street, particularly people of color or those in marginalized communities, feel part of the community if they are concerned that those who are there to protect public order are going to abuse that power by taking advantage of them or treating them differently.
Rama, thank you for the call. I want to get back to the Harley Breer case, though, because I did have a couple more questions about that. And Rory Tebow, I appreciate your flexibility here in answering a question that wasn't really quite on topic, but obviously it is a very important topic, and that Rama raised, and so that's okay. But regarding Mr. Breer, we were talking about his likely potential, I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, move out of state. Do I understand correctly that it needs to be a state that is not contiguous with Vermont, does not border Vermont, and that he is contemplating Maine as a place to go?
That's correct. And so, you know, for many people, they may not be familiar with the ins and outs of Vermont's justice system or supervision system for offenders. We really have two types of community supervision. One is called furlough. People colloquially call it FSU, which is the field supervisor unit, which goes out and checks on people. It is a higher level of supervision. That is a two-serve sentence. It just happens that, you know, instead of being in jail, people are furloughed and are in the community. So that higher level of supervision you do see with a lot of violent offenders after they've hit the minimum on their sentence. If Mr. Breer stays in Vermont, he will be on furlough for life. This was a life sentence on the maximum end, meaning that if he does not leave the state of Vermont, he will be under supervision until he passes away or until he's paroled, whichever were to come sooner. That said, because the status is unique in Vermont of this to serve in the community sentence, it doesn't allow for transfer to another state. During the course of negotiations back in May, his counsel brought to my attention a very realistic possibility of him being able to move out of state. One of the demands I made as a state attorney in any kind of resolution, notwithstanding, you know, where the evidence was to make sure that really two things. One, his sentence had to be at a higher level of supervision, so furlough in the community if he was to return to the community. And second, it had to be for life. Obviously, that wouldn't allow him to leave the state of Vermont. But the reason for having a higher level of supervision is just, as we mentioned before, the notoriety and the fact that he still has victims who are in their families who are in these communities. His risk of being supervised is necessarily higher here in central Vermont, where he's lived and has these connections and, you know, in people he could impact. Not to say that he doesn't present general risk, but the risk to those individual people that requires a higher level of supervision is somewhat unique to Vermont and the immediate area, which is why part of the negotiation process was if he can, in fact, before November 1st, be accepted by another state, his sentence would be probationary in such state, and he could be subject to supervision there. There's a clause that if he ever comes back to Vermont, if he decides to move back after 5 or 10 years, that constitutes a technical violation of the agreement and the probation warrant, meaning he would be elevated back to that heightened level of furlough supervision, if that makes sense.
Okay, so let's say he doesn't. Well, first, I guess one question I have is, why would another state want this guy?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. So the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision really has some, you know, baseline criteria. One, that people can move, offenders under supervision can move from state to state if they are able to demonstrate ties to that community, either through a job or through family members. And ultimately, just because somebody is convicted of a felony or misdemeanor or is under some sort of correctional supervision, it doesn't deprive them of their right to move someplace else in the country. So when we have somebody who enters a plea or is under supervision, we're not asking them to permanently waive rights, including the ability to move somewhere. And in fact, many people, you know, unfortunately, many people do commit crimes who are not from Vermont. And frequently, even though they'll be sentenced here, we see their supervision transferred back someplace else where they have ties.
Okay. Rory Tebow, I'm wondering, so if I understand the plea agreement correctly, does he go back to jail November 1st if he has not found a location out of state?
No, that's not how it's structured. He would remain on the elevated level of supervision. So, you know, home confinement is roughly equivalent to, or maybe just a little bit above in terms of the degree of supervision, the furlough structure we talked about. So he'd be on a furlough status, not probationary.
And I understand you were talking about sometimes you'll try to bring a case which you know, where all the evidence you thought you had or hoped you had doesn't quite come in. And so you have to do, you know, you feel like compelled to do a plea agreement as a prosecutor. That's pretty much a normal part of the way the, you know, you likened this to a baseball game earlier, and that's sometimes how the game goes. Things don't turn out perfectly from anybody's perspective, for sure. But I wondered, given the record to date, would he be eligible for a habitual offender status, which I think I understand could bring a life sentence?
So he was subject to habitual offender, and we did enhance the penalty here, which is why the supervision term is now up to and including life. So that was, you know, again, an important factor here, since he had three prior felony convictions.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And so, but I think most members of the public out there, sort of lay people who don't follow the criminal justice system in anywhere near the detail you do, sort of assume that if you are determined to be a habitual offender and you are subject to a life sentence, that is actually going to be in incarceration as opposed to furlough in the community. Where am I going wrong here?
Yeah, so it can be. I will say that, you know, the Vermont's habitual offender law came about, you know, some time ago. And in the intervening time period, there's been a lot of controversy, both locally and nationally, about whether or not there ought to be these sort of three strike rules. And earlier in this legislative session, I can't remember if it was in 2019 or this year in 2020, there was a bill on the table to eliminate habitual offender enhancement altogether. So it's not, again, it's not without controversy. And Vermont does have a system of justice that's designed around long-term supervision in many cases, but very, very few cases do we see, you know, a true life sentence being served.
I see.
Inside,
okay.
And behind bars, that is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that is what we have playing out here. So Roy Tebow, the Washington County State's Attorney, we are fast running out of time here. I just want to tell you, I really appreciate you coming on here and talking about this case. It is a tough matter, and I think there, you know, as I say, there's a fair amount of upset in the community. So thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Well, I certainly appreciate it, and you know, I just want everyone to understand that we do our best with what we have, and public safety is our top priority. And while we don't always get what we want in these cases, we try to do and take steps that do assure public safety and
all right.
confidence.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
And we are heading into a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. A couple of words from our sponsors. Just discovering one of the dangers of working on the porch here is sometimes a truck goes by. It gets a little noisy, but sorry about that. Alrighty, let's go to the break.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back and scheduled to have Curtis Reed Jr., the executive director of the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity, on the radio this morning. And we have not been able quite to raise Curtis yet, and so we're hoping he will be joining us shortly. And we have a lot to talk about. Certainly, Curtis has had some, was on the, actually on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about then news developments in this whole situation revolving around the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of Minneapolis police officers. The discussion then really focused on the outpouring of national protest and demonstrations. Outrage over not only George Floyd's death, but frankly, too many incidents like this in the preceding years, all the way back to really early American history. This is a culmination of a long and unhappy history of white people basically being racist toward people of color. I believe we have somebody, we do have Curtis Reed actually joining us on the phone this morning. So glad that we connected with Mr. Reed. Curtis, good morning. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
All right.
So lots to talk about. When I spoke with you on Friday, we were discussing the idea of the president going to Tulsa, Oklahoma, for a political rally, a re-election campaign rally, on June 19th, also known as Juneteenth, and that actually has generated enough upset that in a very, I think, unusual move, and maybe a somewhat hopeful move, the president Trump has decided he's going to put off his visit to Tulsa by a day so that he's not there and on the scene of this historic horror show, horrible acts by basically white area residents nearly 100 years ago. I think it was 1921. The Greenwood neighborhood, mainly African American neighborhood in Tulsa, was essentially destroyed and hundreds of people killed. Thousands left homeless by an attack by whites on this neighborhood where black folks were living and working and having businesses, and it was considered one of the more prosperous communities of color in the United States at the time. And so then the other piece of history that was being maybe put in some maybe it was getting a lack of respect here, shall we say, was Juneteenth. And Curtis, maybe I should let you speak here and tell us the story. What should our listeners understand about Juneteenth?
Well, Juneteenth is the day that the last group of enslaved Africans found out that the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed. Which was 2 years earlier, but it took 2 years from 1865 until 1867 before word had spread westward into Texas. And
wow!
So it's the celebration of the last enslaved people learning that slavery was over.
I thought it was 1863 that Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation,
yes,
and that this actually occurred in 65. So,
65.
Just want to make sure we're all square on the dates. I think one rather astounding thing is the idea that people who are enslaved would not know about their emancipation for 2 years after the president announced it. I mean, I suppose some of this is just communications were nothing back then like they are today. You know, today they'd probably have a Zoom meeting about it. Back in those days, it took a long time for news to travel, but not usually 2 years. I mean, that was a little... the famous story, 19th right. century story about communication being slow, actually came at the end of the War of 1812, which was in 1814, I believe, when the Treaty of Ghent was signed, ending the war. The news did not arrive in Louisiana fast enough to prevent the Battle of New Orleans. So that was another case of communications traveling. Mm-hmm. Rather slowly, with tragic results back in the 19th century. Go ahead.
No, I would contend that that the slave owners knew; they just didn't tell. I believe that there was probably sufficient communication amongst the amongst the elite that that they knew, but they withheld that information, and it wasn't until the movement of formerly enslaved people from other parts of the South that ultimately reached Texas.
So this is in other parts of the South, the slaves who were emancipated, and I think the location here, if I recall from my reading, was Galveston, Texas, which is sort of in the southeast part of the state on the coast. And so this announcement came via other slaves who had been freed, and they came down to Galveston and looked around and said, wow, the folks here are still enslaved. We're going to let them know that this is over. We can be free now. Is that how it went?
That's what my contention is. I haven't found any evidence of, there being sort of an official, sort of a reenactment or re-announcement in Texas. I think it was just sort of an organic process where more and more slaves, formerly enslaved people, made their way into Texas.
I see. Wow, that is a pretty amazing story right there. And sure, I mean, I guess if you were a slave owner in those days in Texas, you wouldn't think it were in your interest to tell your slaves that hey, you can all go home now. And the be free, basically go make your own homes, so it really is, and obviously I think that when this sort of freedom is delivered unto people, I'm not at all surprised that there's an impulse to make a holiday out of it and to celebrate that development in our nation's history and so on. Hence, this day, June 19th, is marked by this holiday called Juneteenth, and there the president was heading to Tulsa, but he's now at least moved his rally back by a day. Does that give you any comfort, Curtis?
No, because his message won't change, and I believe it was a move on his part, an intentional move. I don't think he was being tone deaf. I think he knew what he was doing, wanted to deliver a message to his base that that he was going to, insult and black Americans by doing this, both in terms of location and the date. I don't think there's anything haphazard about it.
It certainly seems if it were haphazard, it's poor staff work at the very minimum. I mean, my word. Hey, we have a listener calling in. I think Rich from Starkboro is on the line. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. I'd like to get a fact check. I was on something I was studying, and if it's true, I guess I'm kind of amazed by it. But let me get going on it. Last year, my wife and I we were down to Texas. We went to the George Washington Carver Museum, and I have to admit that's the first time I'd ever heard of the term Juneteenth, and there was a whole discussion of that, explanation about it. But what I wanted to fact check is I'll reveal my source. My source was Wikipedia, and What I think I read on Wikipedia, what I think I understand, is that the Emancipation Proclamation only applied to the Confederate states. It didn't apply to the northern states. And the requirement that the slaves be released didn't actually have to happen in the northern states until the 13th Amendment was passed, which is like December following Juneteenth of that same year, 1965, which is... if that's true, it seems like the North was slightly hypocritical, which is, I guess, suppose nothing new. But any commentary on that, I'd appreciate, and the fact-checking, everything. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call, Rich. Curtis, what do you know about this? Was there, first off? Go ahead.
You know, there's the histories written by those who are the conquerors, and so it's no surprise that that piece of history never found its way into the history books, much in the same way that the slave trade was largely financed by New England banks and shipping companies. That never found its way into history books. There's a lot of history yet to be taught in our schools, and that's one of the things which we are really trying to stress, is that the sort of the radical reimagining of curriculum in the state of Vermont that starts with genocide of First Nations, with the original sin of slavery, of chattel slavery, and the folks that were writing history books, wanted to gloss over those inconvenient truths throughout history.
Some northern states, I think Vermont was one, although there's even a big asterisk here, which I can get to in a minute if you like, had laws against slavery. So I don't know whether that was that generally was considered to apply to all of them, because I remember sort of in broad categories, and again, this may be the airbrushed version, but the in broad categories, there were the slave states and the free states. And the free states tended to be those that remained in the Union during the Civil War. The slave states were in the Confederacy. And I know there were some sort of border states that were, I think, ended up in the Union, but they probably did have slavery. How did all that break down? Do you know, Curtis?
In the case of the North, the manner in which chattel slavery took hold was very different than it was in the South. Slavery in Vermont, and this is still in our Constitution, was only prohibited for males over 16. For, I think it was 16 or 18 years old. But if you were a child, you could be held in bondage in the state of Vermont. And that part of the Constitution, I think it's Article 1 in the Constitution, speaks to that. And that's making its rounds in the legislature to be changed. But there was slavery in Vermont and throughout New England, albeit on a much smaller scale, 2, 3, 4, 5 individuals, if that meaning, on these hills.
I just wanted to finish up quickly with the president's visit to Tulsa, and because I want to talk about something else as well before the top of the hour, and the Tulsa is a particularly fraught place for the president to go. And I did mention a little bit of that history in the first few minutes of this segment. Curtis, did I get it close to right, pretty much? I mean, we're talking about 1921, a really vicious attack by white rioters on this black prosperous community called Greenwood. What else should people know about this?
Well, it's also called Black Wall Street.
Oh, right, yeah.
As well, Greenwood. It was total unprovocated violence against African Americans, and there was a sense of, and I think there's also like air bombings as well.
Yeah, that's what I recall.
This is part of the narrative of, if black people advance too much, that will attract the ire of white people.
Boy.
You know, well, the, that's where the sort of term, one of the terms of uppity N-word, is that, you know, once one reaches a certain level of parity, that's not acceptable in the minds of white racists, because that simply should not be in their particular cosmology.
Wow, you know, I mean, it really is disturbing when you put it like that, and the knowledge that we have a long history in this country of quite a number of people thinking like that, and that it has not completely gone away at this late date. But, Curtis, I did want to turn our attention just in the last few minutes we have together this morning to the developments over the weekend here in Vermont. We had this really an outpouring of community spirit and support for the idea, I think, of progress on race issues when more than 200 Vermonters showed up in front of the State House on Saturday and painted the words Black Lives Matter on State Street, right in front of the State House, a very prominent spot there. And and then overnight, one individual apparently decided to come by and vandalize the project. And it's just, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's always a small number of people out there who really want to do this kind of bad stuff. And what did you make it when you first heard that this project didn't last a night without being vandalized?
For me, it's symptomatic of the failure of white Vermonters having conversations with folks with bigoted attitudes. That, you know, unless white Vermonters are aggressively engaging the cancer of racism within your ranks, these sort of things will continue to crop up, whether they are, you know, swastikas, you know, painted, you know, leaflet drops from the KKK. You know, scrawling anti-Semitic messages on sidewalks. You know, these are all symptoms of, in sort of our opinion, that white people are not sufficiently engaged. They're in their echo chambers. They're in the comfort of other people who think like them. In these protests, these sort of public manifestations of support for the ideas of dismantling white supremacy and racism. But at the end of the day, you know, they hold up their placards, they go home, but they don't engage, they don't seek out, they don't ferret out where these attitudes are.
More work to do. More work to do, Curtis Reed Jr. I got to go, but thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Okay. All right.
We are going to a top of the hour break for some CBS News. We'll be back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour on this Monday, June the 15th, 2020. And after our top of the hour break, we'd like to go to one of our national correspondents. And today, I believe we have Peter King of CBS News joining us. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for coming on the radio with me again this morning. It's always good
always
to talk
always glad to be on with you from sunny Florida.
Yeah, it's actually gorgeous up here too. I bet you it's not as hot. Anyway.
And you know what? I would trade hot for gorgeous in a minute.
Okay. Hey, the coronavirus. You've been covering that continuing story, and man, it just seems like it's not going away. In fact, if anything, it is getting more threatening and a bigger problem in a lot of places. What are you hearing and seeing?
Well, here in Florida, we have just had 11 out of 12 days with 1,000 new cases or more. In the last 2 days, have been more than 2,000 cases. Number of known cases appears to be doubling about every 31 days. The governor says, well, this is because there's more testing, but health officials and other local officials around the state say it's about more than just the testing. We are well into the second phase of reopening with everything from restaurants to bowling alleys and theaters and parks reopening, not necessarily at full blast, but what happens is people are getting perhaps a false sense of security down here. And while many are observing social distancing, many are not. And that, we believe, is the problem here. And, you know, it's a scary thing. If you live here, some people say, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's overblown, but you have many more. And I will count myself among that because I'm in the most susceptible age group for this thing. We err in our house on the side of caution.
Yeah, I mean, that's wise, and I certainly hope that continues to happen and it continues to pay off in good health for you, because this is not, you know, everything we see and hear also about the disease itself and about people who go through this experience, it is not anything anybody wants to participate in if they can possibly.
Well, no, and so, you know, quite frankly, yeah. My wife and I have birthdays coming up in July, and we'd like to see them. So,
yeah,
you know, we don't want to get breathed on and infected by somebody else who may have it. And, you know, I don't want to be hanging out with people who aren't wearing protective masks. And I wear my mask when I go out to the store, when I go to the dentist or whatever, because I don't want you or anybody to possibly catch something from me. You know, the mask is not for my protection. It's for yours if I encounter you.
Well, that's one of the things that bugs me about a lot of the discussion around these masks and the refusal by some folks to wear the masks, you know, including the president. Think about this for a moment. It is all about protecting other people at that point when you put on that mask, because we understand that it doesn't do that much to protect the mask wearer, him or herself, but it is about protecting other people. Many times, you know, there's an end of the political spectrum more likely to have people not wearing masks and sort of thinking, you know, they don't have to, they're free Americans, don't tread on me and all that. Same folks are oftentimes the first to honor our military folks and our police officers, firefighters. And, you know, one thing you can say about military and police and firefighters is they are not afraid to put on a whole lot of gear in the name of protecting other people.
Well, no, and you know something, it's also about self-protection as well. And quite frankly, don't you want them to be well protected? Don't you want them to be safe?
Yes, you want the whole community to be safe, and that's what it's really about. And so when we honor people for being willing to put on this heavy gear when it's 95 or more degrees outside and go out and do the work of protecting other Americans, it seems like one way to honor them would be to take the step of putting a little piece of cloth over your nose and mouth. I don't understand why there seems to be it's a mark of, machismo or something, not to wear a mask.
Well, and there are a number of restaurants and businesses around the country that have said, if you're wearing a mask, we don't want you in here. And, you know, they see it as some sign of weakness. And I don't understand that mentality as well. So, People are.
I don't think it's a sign of weakness when a police officer puts on a bulletproof vest, and I don't think it's
a sign of weakness when a soldier
puts on a helmet. You know, it's not a sign of weakness when a firefighter is heading into a building and you know puts on a bunch of gear first. I mean, come on, this is these are some of the bravest Americans. They get honored all the time, especially by some of the same people who now don't want to take the step of protecting others by wearing this little piece of cloth over your nose and mouth. And I just find that incongruous to the point of being, you know, frankly, making my blood boil. Anyway, the coronavirus, this uptick, the other thing that's interesting to me about this is that nobody is talking about. In fact, here's the analogy, or here's the metaphor our governor uses all the time. He always talks about turning the spigot, as in, you know, taking small steps toward reopening the economy. And that's been really the whole presentation from our governor here in Vermont for the last month or more. But nobody's talking about closing down the spigot in steps because, where's the balance here, the right balance between economic activity and guarding against the coronavirus? Are we now just getting to a phase here where we're going to say, you know, damn the torpedoes, we're going to open it up and got to have the economy humming? And
well, it seems that way in a lot of states. I mean, it's very much feels like that here in Florida, where we have nearly 1.9 million people who filed unemployment claims in the weeks since all of this began. Take a look at what's happening in Texas and other states as well. I mean, there are 20 states, I think I heard this morning, that are showing upticks in all of this since Memorial Day, which was a benchmark date for a lot of reopenings. So,
yep.
You know, people need to get back to work, and people need to make a living, and people need to pay their bills. There is no doubt about that. But, what good is doing that and earning money if you're not alive to spend it?
Yeah, there is that. And although I got to say, I mean, when you think about the sacrifices Americans have made in the past in the name of defending our economy, I mean, you know, sometimes people will say even the Civil War had a lot of economic impetus behind it. Obviously, the ending of slavery was an aspect of it. But you know, there was this the industrial North versus the agrarian South. And they were both interested in kind of protecting their economic interests. So many others of our wars have really been stemmed from, you know, protecting the American way of life, which in no small degree means our economy. So I think that maybe that's the nobody's really saying it out loud here, or not many people are, but maybe we are in a situation here where folks are just saying, you know, our economy is so important that we have to basically take these giant risks and maybe run up a death toll into the hundreds of thousands in order to protect the quote unquote American way of life. I don't know. Is that the sense you're getting now?
I honestly don't know. I think, some people want to ignore the facts and ignore the science. Some people are manipulating the facts and the science to fit their own narrative. I think there's a great deal of truth in what you've said there. But again, you know, with 40 million Americans or so out of work at this point, you know, I get it. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm one of the lucky ones who's still working. So are you. I can't walk in their shoes, and I will be the first to admit that. On the other hand, you just hope that people will do the smart thing as they go back to work, as companies reopen, as theme parks down here in Orlando reopen. You just hope that people will play by the rules because, we don't want this to get any more out of control.
Absolutely. Well, Peter King, I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you so much, Dave.
I want to get into our next segment, which is something dear to my heart. I was in high school band and have had a couple dalliances with various instruments in my life. And I've been thinking lately about the special challenges, tough issues faced by musicians, music educators, and their students in particular, in the face of the coronavirus. And we're going to be talking first with Bill Prue. He is the band director at North Country Union High School up in Newport. And then a little bit later in this segment, we're going to be bringing in the choral director in St. Albans, Armand Messier, and a couple of his students will be joining us to talk about a very special project they've been involved with. So we'll be hearing some about that after the bottom of the hour. But let's start in with Bill Prue this morning, who's on the line with us from up in the Newport area. And Bill, thank you so much for joining me.
Yes, thank you, Dave.
Hey, I wanted to check in and find out from you, just first off, you know, you've had this situation where the school has been closed since March. All the schools of Vermont have been closed since March, and obviously every educational program in the state has had things which, you know, I'm sure a lot of shop teachers are looking around their rooms at unfinished woodworking projects or whatever. But the special challenges in music, because, you know, normally that requires and involves people being very close together and joining in unison and in ensembles. And so have you been able to run much of a music program up there this spring?
So basically what I've done is we've done a lot of listening. I've given some lessons. And, mm-hmm. you know, the lessons don't work great. They can work, but it's very difficult to get a good tone quality from one end to the other. It's not really.
This is what, over Zoom or like Google Classroom?
Right. Yeah. We're using a Google Meet because we use Google Classroom at the school. So,
Right.
It's tricky at best. Sometimes the student's connection at the other end is not very good. Mm-hmm. I've had some students using a phone, and for some reason, when they would hit certain notes, the phone would freak out. It makes it real difficult to listen to.
Yeah.
Listening is a good thing. You know, kids should always be listening to some of the stuff that we're playing or some of the styles that we're playing, but we don't often get a chance to do that during regular class. So being online has given us that opportunity. So, I mean, that's kind of a good thing.
Yeah, I suppose if you have a jazz band, or I think we used to call it stage band when I was in high school, I suppose, it's actually that's not a bad idea to just tell a kid, hey, you know, go listen to Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers or,
kids who are in jazz band now don't really listen to jazz a lot. And so giving them projects to listen to jazz and to get into jazz history is awesome.
Yeah, that's a way to go and a way to maybe supplement and get done maybe some things which might have been, I don't know, I don't want to say neglected before, but just weren't really at the center of your program up there. I mean, obviously in normal times the center of your program is performance and, you know, getting the kids to develop their chops and play better. So that's interesting. Wow.
Absolutely true.
Do you feel like there are, I mean, talk to me a little bit about the outcomes here, if they're known and measurable at all yet. I mean, do you feel like this experience of having kids, you know, go and listen to music that you're playing will contribute to better musicianship going forward for them?
Well, it will help those kids who are participating. I think the biggest problem that I've actually had is getting the participation. You know, we've got so many of the best students in our schools, in our music programs. And yet, across the board, all the teachers I've spoken to have had a hard time getting the same level of participation that we get in a regular classroom.
Oh, sure.
The kids just, you know, it's very difficult for them to get motivated or I'm not sure why, but, you know, I'd say 50% or less of my students are really invested in what we're doing at this point. It made it pretty tough. As a teacher too, because, you know, we get those kids in front of us and that's inspiring to us to want to work with them and to do more and to come up with more stuff. But when they're not there in front of you, it's like our reward is gone too. It makes it so much harder for everybody.
Well, you know, I mean, I've known other teachers, even like foreign language teachers and stuff, talking about how they're having a tough time keeping the kids engaged and so on. And I would imagine that with music, I mean, if you're in school and you're going to the band room, you know, you're going to get out your instrument and play. If you're at home and somebody's saying, you know, hey, Mr. Trombone player, go practice your lip slurs, you know. I mean, then there's always a question of who else in the household is going to be bothered by the sound, you know, and there's always tons of other stuff to do and distractions with, you know, all sorts of just regular life gets in the way frequently. And so I can see how that would be, shall we say, detrimental to somebody's musical development. Hey, Bill Prue, band director at North Country Union High School. I do want to sort of roll the clock forward into fall, because I mean, the governor is saying that he'd like to see schools reopen in the fall. Obviously, I'm sure in an ideal world, you'd like to get back to normal band practices, et cetera. There are some very sort of practical considerations with the coronavirus. One thing is, you know, it's tough to ask your flute section to all sit 6 feet apart. Another one is, you know, how do you play a trumpet while wearing a mask? Or I guess you can't really. And then thirdly, what? I mean, the respiratory droplets that's, you know, I mean, flutists blow across this embouchure hole, and you got to know that there's some moisture coming out of that.
Certainly, you know, in a band rehearsal, I think the three areas I'm most concerned about is, like you mentioned, the flutes. It's right now there's all sorts of studies being done as we speak, because before this all started, they didn't really see the need to study this.
Yeah, really.
Now, so, right?
What
so
a nice world that was, huh?
Exactly. But the flutes, you know, right now, what they're recommending is that you've got 6 feet in front of them, and of course they should probably be 6 feet apart in addition to that, beside each other. So we've got all this space that the flutes need. That's my first concern. My second concern is percussionists, actually, because they are generally sharing mallets and sharing percussion instruments.
Yeah,
I know that, you know, it doesn't transmit as easily through touch, objects, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still something we've got to try to avoid. I mean, maybe we're trying to avoid coronavirus, but at the same time, maybe we're avoiding the spread of just a common cold. So I think we've got to make these changes somehow. And then the third area is, I think, what you mentioned, like with brass instruments, they've got a water key, you know, it's got to be emptied. And, well, even clarinets and saxophones, you know, the water does come out of those instruments.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're going to have to make sure we're keeping the floor clean all the time. We're going to have to make sure our stands are being cleaned off. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to make provisions at the end of class for kids to clean their instruments every single time, carefully.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can't take your saxophone neck off and shake it, because that's going to spread it all over the place.
Yeah, I know. Or even the little string and the what is it? I think cloth that clarinetists use. You know,
sure,
yikes.
Sure, we're going to have to do it carefully.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some other things being worked on. Like we were talking about the flutes before, and they've got these. It's called a wind defender that can go over the tone hole. It's not designed for this. It's designed so that, like, if you're playing outdoors and the wind is blowing, you'll still be able to get a sound. But I think it would work the other way, too. The problem is, then you're talking like $44 per flute. You know, that's a big chunk of money. It might be something we have to do. Plexiglass barriers are another thing we might be able to do between them. We're going to have all sorts of cleaning wipes. You know, if you're cleaning off the stands, if you're cleaning off mallets or xylophones every time you're playing, we're going to go through a lot of cleaning wipes.
We're about to go to a bottom of the hour break here. I just want to ask you one sort of conclusory question here, are you going to be able to run a band program in the fall?
Yes. One way or another, we're going to run a band program.
That's
absolutely
possible. The spirit. Yeah. I certainly hope it goes well. I mean, as I say, I love music, and I really admire, you know, people in your line of work, and I think it's a wonderful thing, and I hope it continues to work. It's going to be tough. So, hey, we do need to hear some CBS news, a couple words from our sponsors, and I think Bill, please stay on the line with us. We're going to be bringing in some choral folks after the break, talk a little bit about singing, and we'll be back shortly, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones to make a brighter day. So let's start giving in. There's a choice to make. We'll save our lives. Each day, just you and me.
That is the Bellows Free Academy Choir from St. Albans, Vermont, and they are doing We Are the World, and it was a virtual choir performance, and you can find it on YouTube. The whole thing is about 5 minutes long, and it is a really beautiful effort, I think, by the music director, the choir director up there, Armand Messier and his students, who include Adsel Sparrow and Sophie Thompson. And I'm lucky enough here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM to tell you that Armand Messier, Adsel Sparrow, and Sophie Thompson are my guests this morning. The three of you, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Dave, for having us on.
Thank you.
And so the virtual choir thing actually reminds me that there was a question I wanted to ask Bill Prue, instrumental guy. He's a band director up in Newport. And Bill, let me just ask you: did you ever try any instrumental virtual performances or actually kids playing together online?
I did try to put together a virtual ensemble a little bit. I tried to do it myself, and it was really tough. And I didn't find that it worked for me. I would try it again if I had some technology help.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I saw one performance by the Rotterdam Symphony. They were doing just a part of the Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the Ode to Joy, and it was a pretty cool thing. I mean, you could see though that it definitely was fairly limited. I mean, first off, that melody is not the most challenging thing I've ever heard an orchestra play, but just the fact that they were all basically hanging out in their kitchens and practice rooms and stuff with, you know, cellos and French horns and everything, it was pretty inspiring to watch that on YouTube. But I must say it also was quite inspiring for me when I saw this kind of similar effort originating right here in Vermont from some vocalists up there in the St. Albans area. So I wanted to ask a couple of the young singers here, who include Adsel Sparrow and Sophie Thompson. Sophie, let me start with you. You were, I gather, at home when you were participating in this performance, right?
Yeah, we did it all from home.
Right, and I see in the video everybody's wearing headphones. You're all listening to each other, and as a singer, how hard was that?
It was pretty difficult because normally in choir, I rely on my ears just to listen to everyone else, just because, like, with harmonies you want to match up and everything. So I just have to make sure that I use the music a lot more in order to have the result that we did.
Yeah. And let me ask you, Adsel, same story for you. I mean, you're singing from home and you are trying to stay in tune and on pitch and all that good stuff. How hard was it for you?
I had an easier part because I'm a soprano, so I had the melody the whole time, which made my job a little easier. But it was still difficult because you still rely on all the other parts to know where you are, and we just had backing tracks. So it was definitely a new challenge, and it was really fun.
Yeah. Do you sort of recommend this? I mean, is this the way to go in the future, or would you think it's much better to all get together at choir practice?
It's much better to get all together. Singing by yourself at home is fine, but there's nothing that beats the experience of singing together with a bunch of people and hearing everybody together. It's truly unique.
Armand Messier, the choir director at BFA St. Albans, how did this idea get generated? And tell me a little bit about when it happened and what kind of reaction that the project has gotten.
Well, it happened when within the first week had an idea. I've always wanted to do a virtual choir. I've seen a couple of recordings. And they always seem to really neat things. But being a performance class, we're always working on performing for our live concerts. So the COVID-19 situation definitely provided an opportunity. You know, it's a fortunate and unfortunate, but in the positive sense, we got to put this together. It was a lot of work. I did all the production on it. So while I'm being a choral teacher, I have background in media. Both in audio and video. So it just took a lot of time. I have to say, to the two young ladies who are with us today, I mean, they were outstanding. I leaned on them a lot, along with some other students. I mean, for Adsel, she was one of the first people I reached out to. Hey, Adsel, she says her part's easy in soprano, but I reached out to her to help build the soprano part for backing track. And you know, she was the first one to record soprano. And because of her part and singing it so well, she could lead the other sopranos who joined and were able to sing their parts. And same with Sophie, you know, she recorded multiple parts along with Adsel. Sophie also sang tenor. She sang alto. They both featured in the solo sections. So, you know, my hat's off to them because you can't do these projects unless you have student participation. And we had a lot of students participate in this.
And had the choir worked up this piece, before the coronavirus pandemic hit? Had you had some practice on it previously, or was this something that was a new piece that you started in the virtual context?
This piece is actually a piece we performed in our concert in the previous semester. So I felt it was good to go ahead and do a piece we all knew, and just really focus on. Doing this performance and having something that we worked on before. So it actually worked out really well. And having the ability to have background tracks that are already pre-recorded was quite helpful in putting this together.
Yeah, that's interestingly, there's a spot in the piece about two-thirds of the way through it or so where a young man injects some hip hop, which I hadn't heard in this tune previously. Was that something written locally, or was that something that was a new aspect of this, or is this something that kind of came as you got the tune even from the publishing house?
Well, that's a great question. This version of We Are the World is actually based on the We Are the World 25, the Haiti version, when they had the terrible earthquake down in Haiti. And the new version of We Record was recorded by the artists. And in that version, there's a rap section. And our student, Hassan Chambers Jr., he did a fantastic job. I like to say he stole the show. And I get all these comments, and everyone's like, oh, we love the group, but Hassan really just takes it home. So the way we did that is bringing in pictures of our local, basically our local heroes, essential workers, just to tie that back into the community. I think it was executed pretty well, and it was, you know, a resounding hit with the community, both local and far. I think we had 1,500 or 1,600 shares on Facebook, and in aggregate, I think we have about 75,000 to 80,000 views altogether on the video.
Wow, that's pretty. You guys have got a hit on your hands. That is pretty impressive, I got to say. And you know, because we're talking about a fairly small community up there in Franklin County, and so wow. And I will confess that when I saw it, I shared it on Facebook, and I got a lot of nice reactions from friends on Facebook who were pretty tickled. You know, I think one person said it brought tears to her eyes, and so that was definitely got a reaction from people, and so I commend, you know, any artists that can put together a performance that is that powerful and draws an emotional response like that. That's a good day, right? What do you think,
it's
Sophie?
It's a great day. It's a team effort, you know, from the students to doing to the community. I mean, it's not going to go anyplace if we don't have people, the listeners, engaged and people sharing the videos. I read every comment on Facebook, and I pretty much responded to everyone. I think out of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of comments, everything was positive. I think there was maybe one comment someone said, well, yeah, I like the original better, but they did a pretty good job. I mean, so it was all positive. And it's just
can't please everybody, right?
Yeah.
Well, Sophie, let me ask you, just your own sort of sense of having been a participant in this project, and I'll put the same question to Adsel in a minute, but how memorable is this going to be as you go through life?
This probably will change my life. As a performer, it's less about feeling satisfied with yourself, and it's more about making others happy. And this project definitely did that. And as a future educator, I want to do that in my life and have the same impact on my students. So.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. What about you, Adsel? What's your sense of all that?
I just recently graduated about 2 days ago, and
wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. This We Are the World project has really been my last chorus concert, and I've been in chorus all 4 years of high school and several years in elementary and middle school. And this being my last performance, my last concert, it is really impactful. I really couldn't be prouder of it. I am so happy that we were able to do this in this quarantine pandemic time. It really will affect me going forward performing. It really means a lot.
Now, do you expect that you're going to go on and study music in college, or what's your sense there?
I don't know if I'll study music particularly, but it will remain a part of my life. I haven't planned to study it as like a major, but I'm planning to take classes and join lots of clubs. I can't imagine a world where I don't perform and I don't make music.
Yeah, that's I think for an awful lot of people who get involved in music, it's something that it becomes a very important part of you. And if you stop for any period of time, you miss it, and you want to figure out a way to get back to singing or playing an instrument or whatever it is. It's an incredibly valuable part of life. I find that it really is a big deal for many, many people. Armand Messier, the choir director in St. Albans at the Bellows Free Academy, how long have you been doing that job, and how long have you been at BFA?
I believe I just finished, or next 3 days I'll be finishing year 19. 20 years in the business of education.
Wow. You're pretty deep into your career now. And so how does this rank among the highlights of your career to have this project that seems to have been such a success?
Well, it's definitely up there. Every 3 or 4 years, I try to do a major work, involve community and do, community chorus and BFA, put them together in orchestra. But and that's all special. Like if I do Messiah or I do Flory Requiem or something that's, you know, big and bold and good for the community. But this is definitely, this is brought to a new level, especially the audience. Just the outreach of knowing that it's been out and it's had all these views. It's really special. And it's something to look back on, a really positive thing, on something that was so negative, you know, losing our classes, losing our students during COVID-19. And it's just one thing to look back and say, yeah, we did this and we were able to do, you know, something really good.
Yeah. And so the video was interesting, too, because I mean, it looked like it was all basically shots of your community there, including inside the local hospital. Is it, I think it's Northwestern Vermont Medical Center. Is that the name of the hospital there?
Yep, Northwestern.
Yep. And so what did the staff there, you know, they're in the middle of, they're all in this gear and they're dealing with this coronavirus. Oh my God, this horrible situation. What did they think when you came in with a video camera to take some shots?
Well, the funny thing is, with the remote learning, I actually never went to the hospital. I just put a call out for pictures, and the response was overwhelming. I put the call out actually to all the employees in Maple Run Unified School District, which is Fairfield, BFA, Salem City, and Salem Town Schools. And there's a lot of people who know people, a lot of relatives that spouses and children that work in the local hospital. And there's some pictures from UVM Medical Center too. And I was just overwhelmed by the response. I got, here's this. You know, I had to verify every photo and make sure that it was authentic and was allowed to be used. But we had doctors and nurses sending in selfies, and it was really powerful to see them in their sort of their uniforms and their safety precautions, and sending that in for us to use. And they were really touched by it too. I can say, like, they were pretty psyched to be featured and you know, for the shout out to them. So it was good for everyone.
I wanted to get back to Bill Prue, the band director in North Country Union High School, just for a moment and ask you, Bill, having heard all of this, success story from St. Albans, do you wish you had pushed harder to get your virtual ensemble into a YouTube video?
What they did was just amazing and inspiring. And I've seen some other choral programs do some virtual choirs at the high school level, especially. I've seen fewer of the instrumental ones. I think there's maybe different challenges or something, but hearing what they're doing there has, you know, I was just taking notes a little bit, and I, you know, I want to do some kind of video or something thanking our community. I think that's such a great, it's so important that we're involved in the community. And I think that's a great idea to do something like that. And I'm going to put the call out for pictures and stuff and see what I can come up with. I think this is great.
Hey, Armin Messier and Sophie Thompson, Adsel Sparrow, my guests from the St. Albans area, I think you've started a trend here. Adsel, what do you think?
I think it's great. It's a new way to put out music and to make people feel great, and it's fun for everyone to do. If this actually catches on, it'd be super fun.
Yeah, and you can say, we, at least in Vermont, we started it here in St. Albans. Well, actually, I should ask Armand Messier, do you know if any other school choirs have done this kind of thing around the state? Did I just stumble on yours and have missed some, or what?
You know, with the graduations just recently happening, I've seen a few come out. They're all different places. I'll say to Bill that, you know, we're all in different places in this. We have to be really mindful of each other. And you know, if you didn't get it out, you know, there's challenges. And you know, my background's in media, so I had an upper leg here. But, you know, there's tutorials out there. I'll be teaching maybe a conference here in the fall for a VMEA conference. And hopefully I can jump in on that and help my fellow educators with some projects like virtual choirs.
Yeah, because I'm sad to say that may be kind of a necessity going forward. I mean, I was asking Bill Prue a little bit ago about just the, some of the really practical and tough considerations for, you know, putting a band on a stage. And do you have to have all your instrumentalists 6 feet apart so they aren't spewing respiratory droplets on one another, and et cetera, et cetera? What about singers? I mean, do you picture a choir practice that would be, I don't know, socially distanced or something in the future, Armand?
I'm actually really worried about this because in choral music, we're more concerned about aerosols and micro droplets versus respiratory droplets, which are aerosols are much more finer than the ones you can't see. And just last month, they said there's really no safe singing until there's actually a vaccine. So, you know, I'm tuning in at 11 o'clock because I want to know the guidance from Secretary Dan French, and I want to know what the governor has to say, and Dr. Mark Levine. It's really important. They're saying they want to open schools, but what's going to happen to our programs? Yeah, I'm planning on going in this fall and doing what I need to do to make music with kids, but we need some guidance around what they're thinking we need to do to keep everyone safe.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions because you know, these are, and as I was saying, I really do think that these programs are very valuable and important to a lot of people. I think oftentimes people think about school music programs as kind of like the caboose on a, you know, in a train that's primarily math and English and, you know, social studies and foreign languages and so on. But I don't know. I've known a number of students who kind of made their way through high school as with music being a big major motivator to keep them in school and keep them engaged and et cetera. And so I just really hope that these programs can continue to thrive in some fashion or another going forward. Bill Prue, do you think you'll when will you get a regular full band rehearsal going right at the start of the school year in September?
No, I really doubt it. I think that when we go back to school, I think there'll probably be some kind of a staggered schedule, and we will have some kind of an online component. I think it's real important that all of us music teachers and all of the arts teachers really stay involved in the planning process going back, you know. We don't want to be forgotten. We don't want to be pushed aside.
Don't want to be forgotten. I got to leave it there because we are just about out of time, unfortunately, on this segment of the Dave Graham Show. I want to thank Bill Prue, Armand Messier, Sophie Thompson, and Adsel Sparrow. The four of you have been terrific. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's hear another sample of that terrific piece they did up there in St. Albans. We Are the World, the BFA Choir. That's it for today's edition of the Dave Graham Show. Tune in again tomorrow, and meanwhile, stay healthy and happy, everybody out there.